So, for our guests here today that haven't heard the first three parts to this four-part series, I'm sorry. You're coming at the tail end of a series of sermons that we have been going through on the word cherish. This is the fourth and final part of that sermon series. In the first sermon, we looked at how God and Jesus Christ cherish us. We looked at their example so we could see this biblical concept that was there in Ezekiel 16 that we spent some time going through. In the second sermon, we looked at the first of what will end up being 11 points. We looked at point one and two in that second sermon, and we looked at how we are to adopt a you're my only one mindset, as well as another point that I am not coming up with off the top of my head. Nope, no idea. And then in the third sermon, we looked at three more points, and I'm not going to even try to do those off the top of my head. I didn't have that in my notes. I thought everybody, I didn't think about San Jose being here today, so you're going to have to just look at them online if you haven't been along this series of sermons. But today, again, is our part four of four. And we're going to start right into it with point number six. And it is the point, cherish with your words. Cherish with your words. Now, some people are naturally better than others at expressing words of cherish than others. That just comes naturally to some. It does not naturally come, it is not easy for me to do naturally. I think it. But it doesn't always form into words that I remember to express. For example, I might look at how beautiful my wife looks across the room and go, "Wow, she looks great in that dress." But if I don't articulate it to her, she has no idea what is going on here in my mind, and that's not communicating cherish. And it goes beyond looks, of course, but words that aren't expressed, therefore, can't communicate that we are trying to cherish someone. So my silence in that case could actually leave her, even though I'm thinking it, could leave her feeling, oh, well, he must not like this outfit I chose today, or he doesn't think I look nice. And that again, my silence could be hurtful, could make her feel unnoticed. But I've learned since practicing this and working at it that cherish can be learned. Even the act of giving cherishing words can be learned, but for someone that it doesn't come naturally to, it takes intentionality, it takes practice for that to become more natural over time. It takes us to take maybe to in that moment to think, how many positive things do I think about this person? And am I actually telling them that? So to sit there for me and go, these are all the positive thoughts I have. How do I verbalize this in a way that would be meaningful to them? Obviously, being sincere always, but also trying to be specific. These can be physical things that we cherish, like we saw in the Book of Songs of Solomon that we spent a lot of time in, where how lovely are your cheeks, or how lovely is your neck, and he would go on to describe that in very poetic words and she would also about stallions and stags and all these things that we kind of laugh at in our language, but it was beautiful imagery, and it made me think of. And even like if you write poems or you read poetry, or even if you like music, we often really like lyrics, don't we? I mean, those are the songs that usually resonate the most. But people, when they want to talk about the love of their life or somebody they think is awesome, they don't just go, "Oh, that person looks great" in the song lyric, right? It's always something really creative. It's poetic. It's beautiful, and that's what kind of communicates that. That level of cherish. In Proverbs 31, we go beyond the physical attraction of someone, and we're going to just go through a few of these verses, but let me, as we talk about this woman, where the question is posed, who can find a virtuous wife? Who can find one? Who can find this virtuous wife? And then it talks about the trust that the husband has in her, that's a cherishing thing. He trusts her. It talks about how hard she works, her diligence. It talks about her strength. So we're not talking about how lovely is her cheeks and her neck and those things, but her work ethic, her strength, her generosity is mentioned. How she speaks, both wisdom and kindness, all these things are cherishing about this virtuous wife. And I'll read just the last few verses here, Proverbs 31, 28 through 30. It says, her children rise up, and notice they call her blessed. They speak cherishing words to her, and her husband also, and he praises her. So it shows this example of we cherish with our words. He says to her, many daughters have done well, but you excel them all. In his mind, that's how he sees her. You excel them all. Charm is deceitful and beauty is passing, but a woman who fears the Lord, she shall be praised. We've been talking through this sermon series how cherish is not like love. There's some overlap to the two, but cherish is really deals with the delight in another. The delight in another. And again, thinking back about poetry and music, smiles that light up the room or eyes that sparkle. It's that delight that is drawn out there. Why are you enamored with your spouse? What do you admire about him or her? What makes you smile about them? What would you miss if they weren't here? Those are the things that we can tell them or express in words. I gave a sermon a while back. This has now probably been years ago, but we went through a series of Sermon 101s where we covered basics of prayer and meditation and fasting. And in that, I talked about in prayer that if you're not praying for your family or your spouse, who is? If you're not taking the time to do it, who else is? And it's kind of this way in cherish as well. If you're not communicating cherishing words to your one and only, who will? And we talked last week about the danger of when someone's not feeling cherished in a marriage, where that opens a door for someone else to try to creep in. And this is another way where cherishing words protects our marriage from infidelity by making sure they're not getting those cherishing words from someone else. They're coming from their one and only. We're the one who's noticing them and being interested in them. So again, our cherishing words guard and protects against infidelity. Cherishing is about deliberately choosing to express our affection and our delight with our spouse in our words. Proverbs 18:21 has this very short verse, and it's impactful. Proverbs 18 and verse 21. It says that death and life are in the power of the tongue. Both are in the power of the tongue, death and life. It's a simple but profound scripture. The tongue has power. It has the power to say, like God did in Ezekiel 16 to that bloody baby, live. It has the power of life. It to build up, to encourage, to lift. Or it can express, die. You're not good enough. You fail. You're miserable. I'm disappointed with you. And again, I caveat certain things. Abusive speech, which sadly is in many marriages, has no place in a godly marriage. Has no place. To explode, to berate, to use foul language, to ridicule has absolutely no place in a marriage. Even if we learned that at home from our upbringing, it must be eradicated with great effort of our own, but also from help from God. Colossians 3:19. Colossians 3:19, again, a very simple statement. I'm going to read this out of the New Living Translation. It puts it clearly and accurately. Colossians 3:19 says this, and it's said to husbands, but it goes both directions. Colossians 3:19 says, husbands, love your wives and never treat them harshly. Never, never treat them harshly. Now, this word, when you dig into this word harshly into the Greek here, it contains this idea of something that would create a bitter taste in your mouth. So the idea is God is commanding us here to never treat our wives in a way that would make life taste bitter. Harshness is the very opposite of cherish. Cherish is not just not saying something negative or not saying something hurtful. Cherish has to be positive. It has to be to move the needle, so to speak, up the scale toward positivity. Again, for some, words of affirmation are their top love language. It comes easy for them to speak words of affirmation. And then that person, if it is their top love language, that's a desperate need they need met too in their own lives. But for some, it's not natural. Others come out of families where they never heard they were loved. Never heard they were loved. Never were affirmed. Someone just messaged me this week, sharing their story with me. It actually wasn't shared because of this sermon series. I think it was shared because of what Sierra's going through. But they messaged and talked about this cycle in their family where they never knew they were loved. And the deep hurt that existed in their life from growing up, never knowing they were loved. That's a sad, sad reality of living in Satan's messed up world. Words really matter. And so does how, not only the words we say, but how we say them. All of us know tone. We can pick up on it. It's not even always the phrase. It's how it's said sometimes. And that goes both into negative or positive. We've explored in this sermon series, Ephesians 5:29, where it talks about Christ nourishing and cherishing his bride, the church, and that we're told to do that as well. It's our job to nourish and to cherish the flesh of our flesh, the bone of our bone, our one and only, to encourage, to build them up with our words. It's our job as we get married to become our spouse's biggest fan, their biggest main encourager. It's not the children's job. It's not the church's job. It's not our employer's job. It becomes our main job. It's our job to see their positive qualities and affirm them. Now, author Sam Crabtree had an interesting quote that I'm going to read to you. He said this: if God is sovereign and every good gift is from above, then not praising the good in others is kind of sacrilege and soul sickness. So in other words, if we can acknowledge every good gift is from above, and so everything good in my spouse came from God as a gift from God, and we can praise and acknowledge that, well, not praising and acknowledging that, not seeing that, not taking the time to praise what God gave and put in our spouse, is there's something wrong with our Christianity if we're missing all that goodness of God and we're not picking up and praising on it. We often, when we walk around, right, we usually people do this really well. We see a sunset, right? You pause and you stop, and we often will think, wow, God, look at the beauty of this sunset that you made. Or we go to the feast and we see mountains, or we see the ocean, or we will pause and we'll praise God. Do we do the same when we see this beautiful gift that God put within one of our spouses? We would pause and we go, wow, God, look at the talent. Look at the gift. Look at this quality that you gave my spouse, and worship in our hearts and our minds, but also remembering to communicate that to our spouse. We want to see it. We want to proclaim it. We want to praise it, to make sure we verbalize it. It's just not enough to think it. When we talk about words, words have power. In the book Cherish that I've referenced from Gary Thomas, he talked about the power of the word babe. And since he talked about this word, and my wife and I read this book together, you know how many texts I've gotten that start with the word babe? Could you take out the trash for me? Hey, babe, would you make sure to do X, Y, or Z? But even though I know why she added the word babe to the beginning, it's because It's disarming, right? Immediately, I read that text through the lens that my wife loves me. She might be asking me to take out the trash, but she's purposely framed it to make sure I first read it through a lens of love and cherish. And it works. So even though I know where she got it, I appreciate the fact she internalized that enough that she went, I want to make sure I make that change in how I communicate. And I tell you, it's much more motivating to get up and take out the trash when it started with babe than if that wasn't there. Words like these have tremendous power and they're simple. It's a subtle change, one word added to the front of the text, but how it impacts can be a big difference. It reminds us that our spouse isn't an enemy. There are one. We can use words like that to cherish even when making that kind of a request. It's about intentionally speaking in a way that avoids life tasting bitter, makes it not harsh. It makes it, again, kind and caring. It's about intentionally choosing to make our words land in a softer space. All right, so point six of this final four-part sermon is to cherish with our words. Point seven, learn and know your spouse. Learn and know your spouse. It's probably a duh statement to say that every person is unique, but it's true. We often talk about stuff like snowflakes, right? There's no two snowflakes alike. Or we now talk about that with our fingerprints or our iris scans and things. We know God made all those things. There's not one that falls like the other. Our spouses are all unique. They're each different. They're not meant to be the same. What one wife loves, another may hate. And the same for husbands. To truly cherish our spouse, we have to know them. We have to know what they really appreciate, what they would think communicates cherish, what communicates to our spouse that we delight in them, that they are treasured by us. Our spouse isn't like anyone else, so we have to know and learn what makes them unique and special because they are one of a kind. They're made for us. To make them feel cherished, we have to know them. We have to know, again, what's unique and special about them in ways where we can then meet them there in their uniqueness. We can't cherish a spouse for who we wish they were. That's not going to make them feel cherished. And it might well do more harm. So you have to ask yourself, how does my spouse or my one want to be cherished? And again, I'll pause here. I don't have this in my notes, but as I've said in this series, for those that are single, these things apply to any relationship you want to be close with. You have a great friend, you have a someone you want to communicate that you love them, you cherish them. You're going to have to know them. You're going to have to know who they are, what makes them unique, or they're not going to feel cherished in that relationship. And even if you've been married decades, we might not know this as well as we wish we did. This requires a lot of study, a lot of time listening to someone to find out who they are, what motivates them, what hurts them, what makes them feel indulged, what scares them. How they feel like to unwind, or what calms them, what fulfills them, what makes them laugh. So my wife likes chocolate. I don't care for chocolate that much. It's not on my list of radars. If chocolate was done away in the world, I probably wouldn't miss it that much, okay? Now my wife loves chocolate, but she doesn't like milk chocolate and she doesn't like white chocolate. Now if I had to choose two chocolates, those would be the two I'd choose over dark chocolate. So if my wife brought dark chocolate to me to cherish me, she loves it. But would I feel cherished by dark chocolate? No, because it doesn't hit anything on my scale. And even if I took her dark chocolate, well, what percentage of dark chocolate does she like? Because that matters. And I, so we have to like come to really, if we want them to feel cherished, we have to know them. We have to learn those details and study them. I have to know that it's the dark chocolate lovers at Trader Joe's that she really likes. It's that level, okay? But and anyway, I've tried to buy lots of other ones from stores that don't hit at the same sweet spot. So, you have to know. Because cherishing is all about particulars. Again, what matters to them? Because even if 90% of other women like it, but your wife doesn't, who cares about the other 90% of women, whether they like it? And the same for husbands. If 90% of men or husbands would appreciate X, but yours doesn't, well, then it doesn't matter. You don't apply it. So we have to pay attention. We have to make mental notes. And that's true, again, for spouses that have been married for years. And I was thinking this morning as I put final touches on here, I don't think any of us probably date enough, even though we've been married maybe for decades. I'll embarrass James and Stacy as someone that do date weekly, and I've always admired that about them. I know there's certain meetings I can't schedule in the evenings one day a week because I know they're not available. And I respect and appreciate that. All of us would be that have been married for a long time, and this is something I need to improve on, is making sure dates are scheduled on a regular basis. Dates are the time we get away from the world and all the things we're dealing with, the work, and we can go. And in that moment, you can sit and you have time to, it doesn't have to cost a lot of money. You can sit on a park bench and you can talk about these things, about what would make them feel cherished and make those mental notes of what's unique about them. You can ask your spouse, you're looking for a date idea? Ask one question. Tell me about a time you felt truly cherished. See where that question leads down a rabbit hole of what it was that spoke to them in that moment of feeling cherished. And then think about other ways you could recreate that in different ways to help them to feel that way. Cherishing is a bit like gift giving in that way. Someone can give you a gift, and they might have put a lot of thought in that gift. But if it doesn't speak to you, how much does that gift land? My wife and I, early in our marriage, I'm going way back 25 years ago, my wife often gave me gifts to meet a need. And that makes sense when you're newly married, you often don't have any money. And so if you need a new tie or a new dress shirt for church, well, this is a good opportunity to use some funds and fill a need, right? But I would often laugh about it because what do I want as a 22-year-old guy? I probably want an Xbox game or something like that, right? That's what I'm looking, I'm hoping as I unwrap the gift, oh, a tie. And we joke about it that it met a need in our marriage, but it didn't necessarily hit cherishing in that way. It's typically best as we try to want to become better at cherishing to lean into the assumption that we probably don't know them as well as we would like, and that in order to learn to cherish them, we have to pursue still learning, still getting to know them. And it can be a great adventure. I can quote this after, state this from experience after 25 years of marriage, diving back into this and trying to relearn and learn my spouse of 25 years of marriage can be still really exciting and a lot of fun to go back through that process and try to get to know them better. This takes learning. And people change over time. If you've been married for 40 years, your spouse is, I guess, I guarantee you could tell me they're not the same person they were 40 years ago. And they probably wouldn't like to be cherished in the same way they wanted to be cherished 40 years ago. So people change over time. I would encourage anyone who's not where they want to be in their marriage to take this as a challenge to start over in that sense of learning and getting to know your spouse. Go on dates. Listen to them of what really affirms them, what really makes them feel delighted in, what they hate, and then what they love, what they don't enjoy, etc. Learn your one and only, because frankly, in your world, like I said before, if 90% of other people, it really doesn't matter. If you're one and only, likes to be delighted this way, that's all that matters. They're the only one in the world that should matter in that category for you. It doesn't matter what anybody else does or doesn't like. Only matters what your spouse likes. In Sermon 1, we went to Psalm 139. I'm going to bring it up again. That was where, in that Psalm 139, in the first several verses there, it talked about, "O Lord, you have searched me and known me." David felt known by God. He talked about how you understand my thoughts. In verse 3, he talked about how you comprehend and you're acquainted with all my ways. You know it. It said altogether. What David was feeling seen, he was feeling known and understood by God. Now, Matthew and Luke both record that God knows the very literal numbers of hairs on our head. And we all know, and some of us know it better than others, that number is always changing, right? And what that's meant to communicate, when God tells us that in Matthew and Luke, and he talks about he knows when a sparrow falls, and then he tells us that he knows how many hairs on our head, and he counts them, it's meant to communicate how closely God knows us and is watching us, how much he is in constant aware of us. So God knows and is, constantly has us in his mind. And that's why scriptures like that are meant to resonate with us. They matter to us because it's meant to communicate a God being who knows us, sees us, is paying attention, not once and then forgets about us for a week, but moment by moment, as a hair falls off my head, God goes, "Well, they want one more." And hopefully it was a gray one. But it's ever changing. It's always changing. God's always watching. He knows, and that communicates our value to him. We know how much we're cherished by him. Your spouse will really enjoy being seen as unique and special, that we love them. They will come to feel that we know them better than anyone else on the planet, and that they just have to be themselves because they are enough. This idea is that they are enough will resonate with some to want to push back and say, "But they're not enough. We all have flaws. We're all imperfect." And well, yes, we all know that. We know we're flawed and we're imperfect. But God's word and our experience, we know without anybody reminding us that we're all sinners, all of us. We talked about in one of the last couple sermons about how James 3 and verse 2 says, we all stumble in many things. Every one of us. So we all fall in this bucket where we're not unique. We all fail in many things or stumble in many things. We all trip up. But if we can only cherish a spouse that doesn't sin, doesn't fall down, doesn't stumble, then no spouse would ever be cherished. We can become impatient and resentful because we don't have a perfect spouse. But to build a marriage of love and cherish, we have to get past this idea of a perfect spouse. They're cherishable when they become something more than they are. We like to say to ourselves, "Well, of course I'm not expecting my spouse to be perfect. Of course, I know they're a sinner." But then at the same time, I'll turn around and get upset when she's imperfect. So we can say that, but we can have a disconnect in our actions and our words. To become cherishers, we have to become good forgivers. To become cherishers, we must also become good forgivers. And that comes out of a place that God reminds us all the time in his scripture of how much we were forgiven, how much God didn't choose to just see our flaws and imperfections. And out of that forgiveness that we've celebrated, we've enjoyed, we then can extend forgiveness and extend mercy as we've been shown mercy. The goal of cherishing is to truly know our spouse, and that means know them in their darkest corners, their areas of failings, their weak spots. To know them and yet to choose to cherish them, to choose to respect and adore the good. Again, we all stumble in many things. We don't all stumble in the same way. Your spouse is going to stumble in a way that you don't, and vice versa. So, can we cherish our spouse in spite of their flaws? Now, of course, love means we encourage, we lift up, we want to help and empower our spouses like God does to us to help us to grow and overcome. But we can't wait on cherishing until our spouse nears perfection. I was thinking through the fruits of God's Spirit and only directing it into how I cherish my spouse. And let's think about those Galatians 5:22 fruits of the Spirit for a second. Can we not just have these as Christians of how we're supposed to interact with other human beings, but can we have those fruits of the Spirit toward a flawed spouse, a spouse that stumbles in many ways, just as we do? To love them, to agape them, to have joy in them in spite of their flaws, to have and be doers of peace with our spouse, to be long-suffering with their faults, to be kind even though they have faults, to maintain goodness and see their good. And part of goodness is to recognize goodness, to remain faithful to them. And that's not just in not quitting the relationship faithful, but not in but not but in sorry, but in not quitting being all these other things, peacemaker, joyful, loving, in spite of the mistakes they make. To be a gentle man or a gentle woman, to be strength under control, to exercise control, self-control over our thoughts, our words, our looks, our actions. All these things can empower our spouse to grow and overcome. Because none of us can expect a perfect spouse. Is it possible, and I say this again from experience, that we give these things more easily to other people than we sometimes do our one and only? That we're more patient, more long-suffering, more peaceable with others? But this is our best friend. But they don't always get our best. When I think of Jesus Christ, I'm blown away by how he treated those who were failing, who were flawed in really open, outward ways. I'm blown away by the love, the compassion, the grace, the patience he met them with. While working with them to lift them up, to encourage them, building them up, helping them become better, but he did that through love and support. And he does the same with me in my life. And I imagine he does the same with you in your life, right? Can we not do the same for our spouse? Sadly, there are many marriages that are trapped in past failures, true failures, but trapped in decade-old failures, where they almost in every, conversation, every fight, something from decades ago comes up again, where there's and what's interesting from an outsider's perspective is sometimes it's very easy for me to sit there and see the tremendous growth of this individual over decades, to watch them transform through God's Spirit working in their life to become something so profoundly different. Now, perfect? No, but better and better and better. What more could we really ever expect from somebody, right? Than to be constantly moving and improving and growing. Yet, sometimes a spouse still holds them in the box that they were years ago. That's how they still see them. They see their spouse before the growth. It's sad, but it's more than just sad. It's a bit scary. Because it shows a real character flaw in the one who can't see the growth, can't forgive, can't give grace, can't and won't extend mercy, and cherish the person they've become. And they chose that person. But that person has grown and changed, and sometimes they can't let go of the resentment and the frustration, and it's holding their marriage back. What if God looked at you and me that way? That's a scary thought. What if God still saw Troy at 20 years old? I hate that guy. I've talked about that. That guy needed to die and go under the ground, and he did at baptism. But I look back and I sometimes stand next to my wife who had to date that guy, and I go, yeah, I hate him too. He wasn't always a good guy, didn't always do things the right way, and I still don't, but I wouldn't want to. I mean, if she held me back or held me in a box from who I was when I was 20, but what about when I was 30 or 35? I won't keep going, but. It's a scary thought if God looked at us that way, and thankfully we know He doesn't. As Christians, we're striving to have the mindset of God and Jesus Christ. That's what we're striving for. When our spouse stumbles, can we respond with gentleness and kindness and patience and suffer long with them, surround them with grace and support and encouragement? When we see a spouse that is trying, Caleb shared in this off notes, but he shared overcoming. Overcoming's a beautiful thing. I mean, that's when you go to the end of the book, that's what it's all about. To him who overcomes, to him who overcomes. The failure and the struggle wasn't the problem. It's growing out of that. And it's a beautiful thing to see somebody overcome. When we see our spouse trying, but then they fail, you know they're trying, but they fail. They slip up. Can't we be the one who comes up alongside them and says, oh, babe, I'm so sorry. I know how hard you've been working at this. I know how well you've been doing. I'm proud of you for all the hard work. You never know what part of a notes are going to hit you in a certain way. I'm sorry you feel beaten down at this moment and defeated in this moment, but I know you're going to get back up. I know you're going to move forward. I'm here for you. Let's talk about it. Let's talk about why you stumbled, but I'm here to support you. What would that do in somebody's life? That's what people need. We don't need to be. Real people have hormones and they have bad days. Real people get sick. Real people get hungry and then get hangry. Real people get cranky. Real people have bad days at work. If we can only cherish people on the good days, on their best days, we don't cherish them. We must meet people in their humanity and accept their humanity. If you want a better spouse, and all of us want our spouses to become the best version of themselves, but if you want a better spouse, cherish the spouse you have. Over time, they are likely to grow, as we saw in Ezekiel 16, of that baby into a beautiful person. That's the biblical model, that none of us were cherished by God when we became cherishable. All of us were cherished out of an unlovely place. And God, through his cherishing and love, built us up. The reality is, moving toward a better and better marriage involves how we likely handle frustrating situations. Where we can meet our spouse and their humanity, meet them with grace and kindness and gentleness. Gary Thomas, in his book, talked about something that doesn't necessarily take a quote to understand, but I liked how he put it. It just said, it's not a choice to cherish, it's 100 choices, and then 1,000 choices, and then 100,000 choices. Meant all these things are either it's bit by bit that you're making choices that all move the needle one way or the other. And over a lifetime, the more you're choosing to cherish and move that needle toward positivity is going to bring about good. good things, but if you every time you move the needle in a negative way, it's going to hurt. So that was learn and know your spouse. We're going to move a little more quickly through 8 through 11. Number 8 is cherish through touch. Cherish through touch. In a number of places, when the Son of God was walking on this earth as a human, he touched. And he touched in ways and for people that was impactful. There was a time in Matthew 17, 7, we won't turn there, but the disciples there are recorded as being greatly afraid. And he didn't just talk to them, it records that he touched them in that moment. It was impactful. We also see in numerous accounts that he touched lepers. And if we won't go dive into that, but we know that that didn't happen in that culture. You didn't touch a leper. He didn't have to do it. He could have just told them, be cleansed, go on your way. But he took the step to touch them in their humanity and their disease where they were. When Parker, since he was little, he's not in here at the moment, but he started to cry as I handed him off just a little bit ago. Parker's my buddy. And from the time he was little, when I would come out of my bedroom or wherever I was working, or he'd get up from a nap, he would come over and he would immediately give me a hug, and he would let me rub his back or pat his back or like kind of scratch his back a little bit. And the family would always marvel at this because Parker doesn't stop moving for anything. He's always off exploring, climbing, touching, doing things you don't always want him to be doing, but he's on the move. But he would stop for like 15 to 30 seconds just to enjoy this moment of touch. Neurologically, hugging and touch releases a chemical called oxytocin in our brain. And some have called it a cuddle chemical. Because it promotes feelings of devotion, trust, and bonding. And so hugging or touch really lays a biological foundation and structure for connecting to other people. As I was thinking about this, I was thinking about how 25 years into marriage, you can give a hug that really has very little meaning if it's rushed. You have to make a conscious choice to slow it down. And when you do, and I've again, this has come through practice after studying this topic, a 10-second, 20-second, mind-blowing 30-second hug is radically different than some quick hug. And all of a sudden, the world seems to slow down and almost stop in that moment, and it releases a chemical, and all of a sudden, there's a connection made through nothing but just extending the hug longer than you might naturally in the busy pace of life do. It communicates an intentionality toward cherishing. A short hug can kind of lack or can kind of communicate a lack of priority. It's an obligation, and I've done that. Just something you do out of habit and practice, but that isn't meant to communicate cherishing. But a long hug can communicate that our spouse is worth pausing life for, is worth stopping to communicate our love to. It breaks my heart when I hear that there are some spouses that never are touched, never hugged, never kissed, and that shouldn't be. It is a failure of the marital vows. If a spouse has been faithful to their marriage vows, then we would understand, as we talked about in the previous sermons about the scripture, to talk about holding hearts hostage. That when we get married to someone, we own their heart in that way. We hold it hostage. And therefore, who else are they supposed to get hugs and affection from? No one else. You're their one and in that way. And so when it's withheld, that's abuse. That's abusive. We covenant before God to cherish. It's commanded in God's word. And so we will one day, like all the other things, have to give account for doing what we do, and we'll have to stand to give God account. So that point 8, cherish through touch. Point 9, knead your spouse. Not knead like you're doing to a bunch of dough. Need your spouse. The other's abuse. I'm just kidding. Sorry, that wasn't in my notes. Sometimes they just come out bad. Pastor jokes. Need your spouse. All of us, if you write down a fundamental list of needs on a board that every human has, every human has needs to feel needed. We want to feel like our skills, our knowledge, our talents are valued in a relationship. And if that isn't true, if we don't feel needed, if we don't feel valued, that our skills, knowledge, talents are appreciated, we won't feel cherished. If you don't ever let your spouse need you, they won't feel cherished. When we go back to the garden, and again, we visited this in this sermon series, but in Genesis 2:18, we clearly saw that God looked at Adam and saw that he needed a helper. A helper. The word in the Greek or Hebrew is ezer. It just simply means someone who helps, someone who aids. He needed someone in his life that he didn't have that was meant to bring value. Marriage is about two people who support and help each other throughout their lives together. Now, again, I've been doing a lot of admitting up here, but I'm going to just keep doing that through this sermon series. It goes against my natural instinct to ask for help. It just does. Somehow in my brain, even in a moment where I know I'm running myself ragged, I'm at the wit's end of the amount I can take on and stress, but I have a difficult time going to Cindy and saying, I need help. Now, it has nothing to do with Cindy. It's a flaw of my own. In that moment, I somehow convince myself I'm making her life easier by keeping things off her plate, that I'm, keeping all my stress, all my work, because if I give her something, now she's got one more thing, right? But that's how I think about it. But what it can actually communicate in this idea of cherishing is you don't have anything to offer me here. You see how stressed I am. You see all the work I have. I don't value your knowledge, your talents, your abilities to help me out of my place of struggling. But then on the flip side, if I could go to her and say, hey, I really need your help. I know you have strengths and talents in this area. It would be a big help if you have it to give. And, then she has to decide if she does. But that is my affirming her worth and her value of being able to ask her and invite her into my life. If we never allow ourselves to need our spouse, they will think that we don't think they have anything to offer, no strengths that we could leverage, and they will feel uncherished. So, need your spouse. Utilize each other's strengths. And that's point number nine. Point 10, save energy for your spouse. Save energy for your spouse. I love the job of being a minister. And I mean that. I sincerely love it. It is something that every day I wake up at such a special opportunity. I feel like pinching myself that I get to wake up and do this every day. It's a wonderful, wonderful thing. But it also comes with an endless list of things that can be done. Every day, there's more than I can get done. Every week, there's more than I can get done. And we're all limited on how much time, energy, and focus we have on all the things that we collectively have on our plates. Therefore, all of life is about choices. Choices to use time for one thing or another and how that time and focus is spent. If you're a mother, then you know how much time mothering duties take, jobs, hobbies, exercise, helping our children grow into successful adults, other things, music, entertainment, everything is a choice about where time and focus goes. Every second given to one thing is a choice to take it out of another bucket. Because it's not a limitless resource. I thought about how Moses had to get to the point that out of his deep love for the people that he was serving, he still had to heed his brother or his father-in-law Jethro's advice and say, I need help. I need other people that are capable and have talents and strengths to do this so that I can have time for the things that really need my attention and the people that I really need to be there for. I thought about Christ, how Christ would save back time out of a day to make sure he had a relationship with his father. That God got his relationship first. that he would take time away from the multitudes to spend with the disciples. He had to choose intentionally. I can't be everything to everybody all the time. I have to choose. To live lives of choosing to cherish our spouse, we have to always monitor and be wary of where we're choosing something else or cherishing something else too much. Now, everything in balance, of course. We have work, we have jobs, but we have to protect and guard our energy to cherish our spouse. If I do a lot of great things, and I can list my things every day, right? I could fill a day full of great things that I do as a minister and a part of my day, and they could all be good things, valuable things. But if I don't save any energy for my spouse throughout the day, any focus for her, well, how is she going to feel cherished? We all need to make an effort to save energy for our spouse or those that we want to feel cherished. That was point 10. And our final point in this sermon series is value your spouse's opinion above others. Value your spouse's opinion above others. Now, again, a time to admit something. Anybody ever got in an argument with your spouse and you're just not seeing it the way they're seeing it? So you go to one of your friends and you say, "Look at what's going on here. Like, this doesn't make logical sense, right?" And your friend, after you laid out the facts on your side, of course they agree with you. They're your friend. If not, you're getting a new friend. But they agree with you, right? And you're like, "See, I knew she was the problem here, right? Not me." They've confirmed it. If you want to become someone more cherishable, we have to realize that our family, our friends, our extended, family, their opinion of us isn't as valid as our spouses. Our spouses are one. No one else is as hurt or inconvenienced as our spouse will be. Our spouse is more keenly aware of who we are than anyone else. It's one thing for our friends to occasionally visit our flaws. It's another thing to have to live with them, right? Marriage amplifies everything. If something I do or don't do really bothers my spouse and I want a more connected, cherished relationship, then that's all the motivation I should have to get more serious about addressing it. But you might ask, "Well, but didn't you talk about how she should, be there for us even in our flaws? And shouldn't they, value and love me for who I am?" And yes, but as our side of the equation, we all understand the Bible has called us to become something different than we are. God doesn't call us and say, "Troy, never change. I love you just the way you are. And you make no changes, no suggestion box, you're good," right? No, we know that this calling is about becoming something different. So God loves me, He cherishes me all the way through the process, but it is about me growing and becoming the best version of myself. If you wanted to live how you live, then you should have stayed single. You chose to be one with another person, and that involves looking for areas where we can grow closer and make modifications where we do things differently. Our spouse likely has strengths in areas that we're weak and is willing to help us to grow in those areas, to help strengthen us in those weak areas. That's why Eve was made as a helper for Adam, and Adam was her helper. Together, they could become more than they were separate. Couples, by design, come together to form something they couldn't have been on their own. In 1 Corinthians 7 and verse 3, 1 Corinthians 7 and verse 3, it talks about let the husband, 1 Corinthians 7 and verse 3, let the husband render to his wife the affection due her, and likewise also the wife to her husband. So this goes both directions here, to render to the spouse the affection due. This word affection is translated in Ephesians 6:7 as goodwill. And it comes from a word to mean well-minded. It means that we're good-willed toward someone. So both husbands and wives are commanded here to be good-willed toward one another. And that's really what this sermon series has been about, to be good-willed toward one another. The context of this scripture is about husband and wives being good-willed toward each other sexually. It goes on in verse 4, the wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does, and likewise, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. And we understand through all this that God designed sexuality between a husband and wife to be a really special, unique, shared thing. That attraction was built into that design by God. Attraction is supposed to be a major part of relationships. I've always admired a spouse who wears their hair in a certain way that their spouse likes. Not because necessarily that's what they would choose for themselves. They might think, well, I'd rather pick this trendy hairstyle or this, you know, this style that's in style, but I choose my spouse because I love them more. They're my one. Shortcuts might be in, or bangs might be in, or whatever it is, but if the husband doesn't like it as much as something else on them, who are they dressing for? We should care about what our spouse thinks of us. My wife doesn't like facial hair. Now, during the week, you guys don't normally see me, not on Sabbath. I shave for you guys on Sabbath. But throughout the week, sometimes I don't do this as much as I like, but my wife does not like facial hair. Now, thankfully for me, it doesn't grow in real well. If I tried, it would look really bad. Here on the sides, it just comes in really sparse, and it would be really a bad look on me. However, but let's say I could grow a real manly, distinguished-looking beard. Why would I do it if my wife hates it? So the point I'm making is, like, whose opinion matters most to us? And are we making sure to communicate that? And that, you know, that goes to even how we would dress, right? I mean, do we dress for our spouse or do we dress for other people? Your spouse only gets you. You're their only one. If we value our spouse's opinion more than others, it will communicate to them how much we cherish them. This isn't a point on how to be cherished. This is a final point that I want to make, though. And I'm going to, so you can, I don't know how to caveat that, because it could be 12, but that kind of makes it fall on the list. So you do what you want. Maybe make it an A. I don't know. Maybe if you're an English writer, you know how to make a kind of a counterpoint. I don't know. Allow yourself to be cherished. If you're a spouse, allow yourself to be cherished. Now, this isn't about choosing to spoil yourself, have a love affair with yourself, cherish yourself, be self-focused. This is about giving space to allow your one and only to honor their marriage vows that they made before God to you, because they also vowed to cherish you. And we have to give space for that. And some people struggle this more than others, because some people have been through such profound trauma in their life that it sets off something deep inside that, frankly, I can't relate to, that makes them feel uncherishable. Uncherishable. It's an impact of a satanic world by Satan's design that can impact how someone experiences God's grace and love, and that can impact how they experience it also from spouses and friends. Now, this can be overcome by God's Spirit in one's life and by surrendering one's life to God in a way that over time, and sometimes over a long period of time, trust and faith in the fact that there is no trauma too big for God, that God did make you cherishable just the way you are. Satan doesn't want you to heal. Satan wants you to prolong your hurt and your pain. He wants you to stay a prisoner and remain stuck. And he wants to rob you of all present joy and peace. Now, from my education that I've been doing in this topic, I'll share, this is a long journey out of this spot sometimes for people. A spouse of someone who feels uncherishable has to exercise a great deal of patience, being very intentional in expressing words and actions to that individual that they are enough, they're accepted, they're valuable, they're And that they are wonderful the way that God made them, and that over a prolonged period of time, that person can learn to allow themselves to trust again, to grow, and to heal. And it's a remarkable spouse that can meet someone in this place. To come in such a difficult space where their one and only is hurting, and over years, meet them there. And often we understand someone here would need some professional counseling to come to help them feel cherishable. Moving from a state of feeling uncherishable starts with that God and Jesus Christ, who they are, that they love you, they cherish you, and that's why I started this whole sermon series with that focus. That's where we always have to start with, is you are loved and cherished by God and Jesus Christ. Do we believe, it comes to this question in our core, do we believe that God loves the flawed me? Does God love the imperfect us? Do you really believe that? Romans 5:8 tells us that that God demonstrated his own love toward us, that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. Do you believe that? That while you were still a sinner, while we were the biggest sinners, whatever that would be, that's when God met you there and said, out of my tremendous love and cherish of you, I'm going to give the one and only son I have, and I'm going to allow him to suffer and die a death that covers and wipes out your ledger, makes you whole. You are enough. If we can't believe that God can love an imperfect us, how can we allow our spouse to love an imperfect us? It starts with God and Jesus Christ. A God who demonstrated his perfect and complete love for us, that he allowed his son to give his life for us, to free us, to heal us. We have to start with that God loves us. So, in conclusion, brethren, to this sermon series, throughout this series, we've explored what it truly means to cherish, how it goes beyond love alone. In our first marriage, we began with the perfect model of God and Jesus Christ, who do not simply love us in a covenant commitment, but they also delight in us. They showcase us and heal our brokenness. Their example reminds us that cherishing is not earned by perfection, but is given by intentional choice and overflowing grace. In the second sermon, we turn to the Song of Solomon and the creation of Adam and Eve, to highlight the you are my only one mindset. You are my only one mindset. To cherish is to delight in our spouse as incomparable, refusing to measure them against anyone else. It is to showcase their beauty, their talents, their uniqueness, lifting them up with joy and admiration. In the third message, we looked at and were reminded that to cherish our spouse, we must notice them, we must protect them, and we must guard them. And finally, in this fourth sermon, we saw how cherishing comes alive through our words, our touch, our unique knowledge of our spouse. To cherish is to speak life, to express delight openly, to hold and embrace with warmth, to keep learning the uniqueness of our one and only. It is choosing daily to show mercy and patience and encourage rather than harshness or indifference. Cherishing is not one grand gesture, but 1,000 small choices made daily that communicate, I see you, I know you, I delight in you, and you are my only one. This is the way God cherishes us, and it's the way we've been called to cherish one another.